Pushkin. Don Was remembers the exact moment music changed him. He was 14, running errands with his mom, when Joe Henderson's Mode for Joe came on the car radio. Joe's tenor sax taught Don an important lesson you'll hear about later in this episode. It also cemented his love of music, which was everywhere in Detroit in the 1960s. From Motown to the Stooges to George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. It's no surprise a city as musically diverse as Detroit turned out someone like Don Was, who's worked across generations and genres for decades now. He led the avant-garde new wavy band Was Not Was, produced career-defining albums for the B-52s and Bonnie Raitt, including her biggest hit, Something to Talk About. He's also worked with Bob Dylan and is a Rolling Stones go-to producer. For the last decade, he's worked as the president of Blue Note Records, reviving the same legendary jazz label that issued Mode for Joe way back in 1966. Rick Rubin caught up with Don Was to talk about his wide-ranging career and why his latest gig playing bass for the Grateful Dead's Bob Weir is the single best thing he's ever done. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Don Was.
Should we start with Detroit? You're from Detroit?
Yeah, sure am. Yeah, I was born in Detroit in 1952, which meant I was a teenager there in the 1960s, which was a really great time to be in Detroit. You know, the Stooges played at my high school.
Wow.
Bob Seger played at my high school. George Clinton, and they were just called the Parliaments then, right? And it was a five-piece vocal group. And they came to lip sync, I Just Want to Testify, at my junior high school at a sock hop. So there was incredible music and there was an incredible atmosphere in the city. You know, after World War II, people from all over the world started heading up there to get jobs in auto factories, and they brought their cultures with them. And they all kind of, it was like going to a great bazaar every day. You could hear all kinds of music and meet all kinds of people.
Beautiful.
There was something about coming from Detroit back then that there was no point in putting on any airs. You know, it was a very honest city because everyone's fate was tied to the success of the auto business. My parents were both teachers. And if auto sales were down, families would move away to find other jobs, and they'd lay off teachers, and they'd lay off barbers, and they'd lay off waitresses. And so there was really no point in like leasing a Mercedes to impress people because everyone knew we were all in the same boat. And that was something very special about Detroit in that era. And I think the music reflects that. If you listen to the people who came out of there, to me, the godfather of Detroit music is John Lee Hooker. You know? And that's just brutally honest, incredibly raw stuff without affectation.
Incredible. Lucky that you found yourself there. It's amazing how the universe plays a role in all of this.
It's incredible.
What was the world in Detroit like? Paint a picture of your childhood in Detroit.
Well, I see it in black and white, probably because we were watching black and white TV, mm-hmm. You know, but I don't see it bright and colorful. There was a grit to the place, but a warmth, man. The people are really nice, man. It's Midwestern, and it's got that Coen Brothers kind of benevolence, but it's urban and sophisticated. So it's not a farm town. It's a pretty hip town, and the culture was great. The music was unbelievable, man. Not just in rock and roll, but you know, certainly everyone knows about the R&B that came out of there.
Yeah.
But like just on the Blue Note roster, for example, there's a really inordinate number of musicians from Detroit who ended up recording for Blue Note. It's an incredible jazz scene.
I feel like there are other industrial places that don't have that legacy. What do you think is specific about what was going on in Detroit, particularly, that created this?
I think it's the combination of no bullshit and having an incredible number of jobs in one period of time that drew people from all over the world. Mm. But it's just some weird phenomenon. It was a booming scene, man.
How long did you stay in Detroit?
A long time, man. I was there till I was in my 30s.
Wow.
Yes, I left in 1986, so started making records there. I loved recording studios. David was my buddy, my partner there. His parents are both voiceover actors. And so I remember them taking us to a place called United Sound, which is the studio where John Lee Hooker cut Boogie Chillin' and George Clinton had it locked out from the late 70s, early 80s. And it's still standing, by the way.
Wow.
And so they took us down there maybe when we were 12 to watch him record some commercials or something. And I walked into that big room and saw all the mic stands everywhere and the cables hanging and all the gear. And it just looked like I wanted to spend the rest of my life in that room, man. Yeah. So that got me going. When I was in my early 20s, there was something called the Recording Institute of America, which had started almost like a trade school, 6-week class in recording engineering. And they franchised it out in Detroit. And the class itself, it wasn't, looking back on it, they taught EQ wrong. They didn't really know how equalizers work. So the curriculum needed work, but it got me in that room at United Sound. And then from there, I was able to con a guy, really. I don't know any other way to put it. A guy named Jack Tan, who owned a little 8-track studio on top of a warehouse. He needed an engineer, and I told him I was a graduate. And and I got in there, and I was able to experiment. Then later, got into a Westlake room called the Sound Suite, SoundSuite, where Aretha recorded and Bob Seger made records in there. It was kind of jumping. And they let me go in at midnight and just start making any kind of records I could.
At that point, were you making purely your own stuff, or did you already start producing other people?
No, though it was the Was Not Was stuff was really the first actual record we made that came out. And that was, we were just trying to create a little microcosm of the music we grew up with. You can hear on our first record, we had Wayne Kramer from the MC5 playing guitar. We had Marcus Belgrave, great jazz trumpeter, who at the time was playing with Charles Mingus. He played trumpet on it. Larry Fratangelo from George Clinton's organization was playing percussion. And it was meant to amalgamate all those sounds and to create the vibe of that period in Detroit and what we grew up listening to. And I didn't know what I was doing, man. We were just doing anything we could. We had no money to work with. So that's a really great thing. When you have no bread to work with, you have to rely on creativity. You can't just hire David Campbell to come write some strings to fill up the bridge and make it rise. You got to find rusty nails and grind them together and put them in pitch and a harmonizer. So it was a great period. I longed for that period in a way where it was an uphill battle. It was a 24-track studio. There were always two tracks that weren't working. So at 22.
That's great.
And somehow we came up with an album. And a guy named Michael Zilka, I don't know if you ever ran into Michael, he owned a company called Z Records.
Yeah,
that had
I know Z
Creole
Records.
And the Coconuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he gave us a deal.
I think also, who else was on the label? The Contortions, maybe?
The Contortions, yeah. Yeah, James White and the Blacks, yeah. Christina, the Waitresses,
yeah.
But Kid Creole and Cody Mundy were the foundational artists of the label.
I got an email from Michael Zilka the other day. So,
wow. Yeah. Yeah. No, he's wonderful. I stay in touch with him. And he was a Medici, man. He was great. He just encouraged us to be as different as we could be. My favorite story with him was, we were recording in Detroit. He was sending us money in little drips and drabs. And he said, I want you to send me rough mixes every night of what you're doing. These are like my babies. Well, at that time, you couldn't just burn files and email them. It meant, and I was working all night too. So at 10 in the morning, I had to stay up, do runoffs in real time, make a cassette, and go to FedEx myself and drop it off for him so he could listen to it the next day. And it got really tiresome, you know. So we said, I said, let's put an end to this, right? So we programmed all these sequencers we had laying around with the volume down. So we couldn't hear what we were doing. We didn't know what sounds were attached or what we're putting. We just banged on them. And then I said to David West, I said, just go out there and yell something, man. And the sax player, Dave McMurray, went out there with them and started playing. But they weren't hearing the music. They were just playing stuff. And he yelled something about, hello, Dad, I'm in jail. So about 2 minutes long, we put it on a cassette. And we brought the sound back up. It was written, recorded, and mixed simultaneously. And we FedExed that to him. We thought that would, we figured he'd call and say, all right, you don't have to send us any more stuff every day.
Did it work?
No, of course not. It was 10 in the morning. The next day I stayed up. I wanted to hear his reaction, right? And he called up and he said, it's the most wonderful thing you've ever done. And he was probably right. It turned out it's been in like 8 different movies.
Wow.
Someone did an animation for it that toured in animation festivals for years. And it was a great lesson in not overthinking stuff.
Yeah.
And dropping self-consciousness and just having the confidence to go out there and do anything. And it was also testimony to Michael's taste that he heard that and recognized the honesty of the thing.
Yeah, it's amazing how these things work. What motivated you to move from being an artist to being a producer?
I never saw them as disconnected. I'm old, but I'm not old enough. I remember the Beatles using the studio as a musical texture. So to me, they were all one and the same. It was just it was another instrument, and I still see it that way.
What was the first thing you produced that where it wasn't your group?
Well, I did some odd things for Michael. I produced his wife, a singer named Christina, and then there were some English groups that wasn't. I was our first album. We did all right over in England, and then we started getting approached by people. But the first big artist to call me was Carly Simon.
Wow,
and she really like went out on a limb. I think Frank Filippetti had worked on some of her stuff, and she was looking for younger people to come in and infuse some new blood. And she took a real chance on me.
And what was the experience like for you?
Oh man, it was Carly Simon. I used to stare at the cover of Playing Possum, right? You know, and now here I am in her house eating dinner with her. It blew my mind. And she was lovely. I was going through a rough period then. I was in the middle of a divorce, and she helped me get an apartment in New York. She actually went to the tenants committee. And at that time, Carly Simon, she's like the queen of New York, right? So of course they wouldn't let me, I didn't even have a credit card, but she came in and vouched for me. And I got an apartment, and she was wonderful, man. I learned a lot from working with her too.
And were you still living? So this is when you were still living in Detroit and then you moved to New York?
I moved to New York while I was making that Carly Simon record. Got a divorce and moved to New York. And then it was an adjustment. In fact, I don't think I ever really found my groove in New York. I was struggling. I was doing the same thing I was doing in Detroit, approaching the records the same, but they weren't getting over. We weren't getting any hits. Then I had this one experience, and this was a life changer. I got hired to produce a band for Virgin Records in the UK. And my wife did A&R at Virgin in the UK. That's how I met her. So she was somehow involved in hooking me up with this band called the Ward Brothers, three brothers from Barnsley, which is kind of like being from Iowa. And they had a little church where they made these great four-track demos, great guitar, bass, and drums. And then a bidding war started over them. And now there's all this pressure. Now you can't go to Barnsley to make a record with these guys. We got to bring them to New York and do it right. So they'd never even been to New York. So they get plonked down in the middle, and it didn't go well. And the A&R guy came in from England and didn't like what he heard. And he pulled the band out, man. He took them home. Didn't call me. I came to the studio the next day, and they were on a plane going back. I didn't hear from them for a month. It was harsh, man.
Wow.
And then they called me in a month. They said, well, we're going to do some overdubs here. We're not going to pay for it, but if you want, you can fly over on your own dime and pay for a hotel, but you can still work on the record. And I had nothing going. So I thought, all right, I'll go. So I went over and I did overdubs with him for 2 weeks. And it was, okay, you're back in our good graces now. Then I didn't hear from him for a month. Then they and they called me and said, we're going to start mixing on this date like it was a residential studio in England somewhere. And again, you can fly over on your own dime if you want, and you can be present if you want. So I flew over, and it was not going well. It was not the right guy to mix the song. He was a good engineer, but he wasn't the right guy. And they kept talking about the A&R guy was saying, it's got to sound like Don Henley. And it sounded nothing. There was nothing on any track that sounded like Don Henley's record. But finally, I said, all right, let me go to L.A. and let me mix the single with Greg Ladani, who engineered Don Henley's records and mixed them. So I fly back to New York. I'm going to pick up my wife. We're going to look at apartments in LA while we're there. So I take a taxi in. We get in the cab at midnight on a Friday. I got the two inch reels under my arm for the mix. And we get up to the ticket counter and she says, wait, where are the tapes? And I left them in the trunk of a New York taxi cab at midnight on a Friday night. And thankfully, I kept the receipt and I had the medallion number, but nothing was going to happen till Monday. And Greg Ladani was waiting for me on Saturday. So I didn't know what to do, man. I actually lied to people. I said I got mugged at what's the bus terminal called there? The Transit Authority. I said I got mugged at the Port Authority.
You know, right? Yeah.
And I called Michael Brower and Media Sound, they were good friends, and I said I need you to help me with this. And we found a reel that had everything but the drums on it. So we had that flown over, and Steve Ferroni came in, and I said, it's a band of brothers. You got to play exactly what he played. And I gave him a cassette of it, and he learned the part, and he overdubbed it, and they all did it for free. And I was able to get on a plane Saturday night, and Greg Ladani said, fine, we'll do it Sunday instead. So I go to the complex. That was it, yes. Yeah. So I go over there to meet Greg, and he says, all right, well, have a seat in the lounge. It'll take 8 hours or something to mix it. And I'm sitting there. I got my Walkman, and I remember Peter Gabriel's album, So, had just come out, right? And I'm playing the song Don't Give Up over and over. And crying. I'm just sitting there with a Walkman on crying, I thought I'd bottomed out. And while I'm sitting in that lounge, because I was working there on Sunday instead of Saturday, when there was a different artist in the other room, Bonnie Raitt came into the lounge. And that's how I met Bonnie.
Wow.
And meeting Bonnie Raitt changed my whole life. So it's a good lesson, man, and how, you know, you can, when you think everything's going wrong, maybe it's really going right.
Yeah, we never know.
We never know. And the breaks really never come from where you expect them to come.
Yeah.
It's always someone you met along the way to do the thing. That's the one who's going to change your life. So I moved out to LA and started recording with Bonnie Raitt.
How long did you work with Bonnie?
Well, we did four albums.
Wow.
But that album, Nick of Time, was the first one we did.
Yeah.
And that changed, you know, that won a Grammy for album. I think it won like 5 Grammys or something. And I really went from being a pariah to having work. I feel like I'm still riding the like the wind from Bonnie Raitt still in my sails. You know?
You've done a lot of good work in between, though. I'll say it.
Thank you. Good. But that was very special working with her, man. She's just such a great artist.
We'll be back with Rick Rubin and Don Was after a quick break. We're back with more from Don Was.
Do you think that there's something special that happens when you work with an artist the first time that's different than when you work with them over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you do anything for the first time, you know, you have it. I think creating and recreating are two very different neurological processes.
Yeah. Right?
So the first time, it's all creation because you have no routine, you have no anything. You're just building a dynamic and a method of working together. Then to go back, then especially if it's been really successful, to go back to that same method and try to do it again. Nah, we actually, I think the second record we made, after the one after Nick of Time, I think that's a better album. Mm-hmm. And it actually had more hits and sold more records.
Yeah.
And it had that song, I Can't Make You Love Me, on there.
Wow.
But we were aware at the time that we had to overcome, that we were aware of the phenomenon, that we were going back to recreate a methodology, for lack of a better term, a pattern that was set on something previous that had just caught some kind of crazy wind and spread.
Yeah, I think more often than not, when you catch that wind, the healthiest thing to do is to just start from scratch on the next one, as opposed to trying to part two it.
Well, you can't, you know, one of the things that I've learned, lately I've been playing live more than ever in my life. I've been playing with Bobby Weir.
Yeah.
Who you did a wonderful show with.
I got to see you play with him.
Oh, you did? What? I didn't know that.
I got to see you play with him in Kauai.
Oh, right. That was a wild night.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
That was a good one, yeah. Well, playing with Bobby, first of all, you can never play the same set twice. And you can, I mean, like ever. You can never put the same list together twice. We have 120 songs to draw from, and we really don't repeat anything for four nights, but they're always put together in a different combination. And on top of that, we never, ever, ever play it the same way twice. It's got some loose form to it, but you don't know what thing is going to get stretched out. I don't know what the drummer is going to play a different beat. So there's no point in playing the same thing I played last night, because everything's going to be different. So the one thing I've really learned with him is that anything but trying to repeat what you did the previous night is probably going to get you somewhere. But you also learn not to worry too much about it.
Yeah.
You know, just go out there and play.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to learn. It was one of the attractions of taking the gig with Bob. I was interested, obviously, in playing with him and in playing those songs. But what I was really interested in was expanding fearlessness. I wanted to, self-consciousness is the enemy of really everything, right? And I just wanted to get better at going out there, not knowing what I was going to do in front of 2,500 people, and just start playing. And it's been great for that. But it obviously has implications in everything that you do in life.
Yeah.
And in making records, I think that's been, I don't stay up fretting over what's going to happen the next day. Yeah. I used to get, I mean, I still get nervous before every session, and it doesn't matter if it's Bob Dylan coming in or it's some 19-year-old kid making a first album, because you really don't know where that magic thing is going to come from.
Yeah.
We all know we can make an okay record in our sleep, but okay is your enemy, man. Just being good is your enemy. How are you going to get that? How are you going to make it great? Something, you know, lightning's got to hit the room.
Yeah, it's completely out of our control.
Totally out of control, right? So that's terrifying. Yeah. I understand why a lot of musicians end up on heroin and stuff, you know, because having to live with that is a tough thing. It's out of our control. So how do you go in and deal with that? I used to get really, I'd feel it in my stomach before every session. Like, where's the magic going to come from today? I don't know. But it always comes to varying degrees. Something good always happens. But you got to open yourself up to it. Everyone's got to be open to the thing. And you got to make sure the tape's rolling when it hits.
Yeah. And be patient. You know, like, that's another big part. It's like, just got to wait for it to, it's like fishing, you know, you got to wait for it to.
Well, that's exactly, it's very much like fishing or surfing. You know, like going out, you got to wait for the wave, but you're going to get one, and it's going to be exhilarating when you catch it.
Yeah, but you don't exactly know what shape it's going to be. You don't exactly know when it's going to come.
Never, never. Every session is different. How do you deal with it?
Same. It's like I always have anxiety before, especially before the first session of any project, because I really have no idea what's going to happen. Usually after we've started, there's something reveals itself as to, oh, it's going to be one of these. You know, it's going to be in this ballpark. And then at least, I still don't know what it's really going to be, but at least I'm calm about it because it's not just a blank page. Do you know what I'm saying? It's, there's some, at least there's a frame that I can see there's where it's going to be contained. And that's helpful.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And it sounds like from your experience with Weir, it's almost more like a jazz approach in terms of playing free.
It's totally like a jazz approach, except the modes and scales are a little bit different. And even then, he listened a lot to McCoy Tyner, loved McCoy Tyner. And he'll do things, like we've referenced Coltrane records as far as to try to shape the nature of our improvisation. And I had to really try to come up with a way to play bass. I'll tell you the story. I was producing John Mayer in 2011, and John got me really into the Grateful Dead again. I'd seen them play in the late 60s, but I hadn't really been like a Deadhead or anything. And John was a fanatic for him. Every time we got in the car, it was the Grateful Dead channel. And he could identify the year that the concert was, even if it wasn't on the screen. He really knew their plan. So I started listening again and started appreciating what they were doing. And then I'd known Bob since the early 90s, but ran into him somewhere and we started talking, and he was looking for something new to do, and how were they going to move forward as a band and all that. Bobby and Mickey Hart came over to my office at Blue Note in the Capitol Tower, and John was working downstairs. I said, man, you better come up here. You won't believe who's in my office. And that led to the two of us going up to Bob's studio in San Rafael, and that was how Dead & Company started. And to be honest with you, I would have liked to have been the bass player in Dead & Company. And I did play, but John, there's about a two-month lag, and John stopped his album, went home, and shedded Grateful Dead songs, and I did. So we got up there. I didn't really know the songs, and I made them sound, when I played, it sounded like a bar band doing Grateful Dead songs, even though it was the guys. But it worked out great with John. But I didn't know how to do what Phil did. That really baffled me. I think he's a really unique musician, and I don't know where he's coming from. It's a unique voice that belongs to him, and I can't figure out what he's doing or imitate him. So I was not the right guy for that. But then Bob called me about 2 years later. He said, let's start a trio. He said, I had a dream. We started a trio.
Beautiful.
And you play acoustic bass. So I started, you know, this time I thought, well, I'm really going to shed, man. I'm really going to practice these songs and I'll be ready. And I was ready, but I was playing a whole lot of notes. And then once we started playing together, I realized that he wanted something different. He wasn't saying play like Phil. He was saying, I want you to play with what I'm singing. Play the lyrics, play the song. Don't worry about the chords. Don't worry about a bunch of notes. I want to be able to phrase, and I need you to support me. So then it became a whole different challenge. Not how do I play like Phil? It became, how do I stay the fuck out of the way of his phrasing and still be supportive? What are the fewest notes I can play that will still provide support, but that won't inhibit his guitar playing or his singing? And that was the challenge. And it is every night, because every night's different. He phrases the song completely differently every night. He approaches it fresh. It's like, what's the next line? Where's he going to sing? Where don't you need to play?
So cool. No, but that forces an interactive nature of performance and focus that if you were playing your same part every night, wouldn't be there. It's like, we know a lot of rock bands that essentially go on autopilot when they play live. And it sounds like this, every night you're in this moment, and much more like jazz again.
It's also, you know what else it's like? It's like meditation.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we play for 3 hours every night. And really, if I take my eye off the ball, I'm going to get hit in the head.
Yeah.
The whole time, I've got to be like inside. And I come off those shows like flying. So exhilarated from it.
So great.
Yeah, it's so great.
Yeah. That's the best.
It's the best. It's actually the best thing I've ever been involved with in my life, playing with Bobby in this trio.
Beautiful.
We'll be right back with Don Was after a break. We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with Don Was.
Let's talk about jazz, and let's talk about Blue Note. So how did Blue Note come into your life?
Blue Note, well, in 1966, I was 14 years old, and I was riding around running errands with my mom in Detroit, and I was being grumpy. I didn't want to be with my mom. I wanted to be out at the mall hanging out with my friends, right? So I was a pain in the ass. So she left me in the car with the keys so I could play with the radio while she went in to do something. I started messing with the dial. And on weekends, the local R&B station, WCHB, would simulcast the local jazz station, WCHD. And I landed on the station. I didn't know anything about it, but I landed on the station, and I came in just as the saxophone solo of a song that I later learned was called Mode for Joe by Joe Henderson. The saxophone solo was beginning. And I could hear like about notes, and it wasn't about instruments. It was a guy talking to me, and he was anguished, man. And so was I, because I was stuck driving around with my mom. So I totally related to the thing. But about 20 seconds later, the drummer, Joe Chambers, who, by the way, we just re-signed to Blue Note, and he's making a new album for us as we speak. Joe Chambers starts kicking in with this groove, and Joe Henderson kind of falls into place, and then he starts swinging, and he's mollified by the groove. And the statement that came through to me from listening to that music, although not necessarily in these words, was, Don, you got to groove in the face of adversity. And sure enough, man, when my mom came back to the car, I was a nice kid again. I was happy. And this music spoke to me and changed my frame of mind 180 degrees. That's 14. I didn't know what hit me. But I did know that I liked the music a lot. And so it was on, they broadcast on FM all the time. And back then, you had to go out of your way to listen to FM. You had to buy a special radio.
Wow.
So I got an AM/FM portable radio and started listening to the jazz station. And I found that a lot of the music I liked was coming from this one little label out of New York called Blue Note Records. And I wanted to know more about them. And I started collecting the records, started looking at them. You know, there's no internet. You couldn't just look at all the covers. So my friends and I, we'd just get on buses and go record store to record store. And back in those days, every record store was, you know, it was like a mom and pop store, and the stock reflected the taste of the owner. And so you'd find different ones in different stores. And I remember once calling around and finding out that there's a copy of Larry Young's album called Unity, which is a Blue Note classic, that there was one on the east side of Detroit. And we rode a bus for 45 minutes, didn't even buy it. We just wanted to look at it,
wow,
read the liner notes, and maybe you could con the owner of the store into breaking the plastic seal and playing some of it for you. So I was just enthralled not only by the music and the message behind the music, but by the whole vibe of it, man. It had these great black and white photos of these musicians sitting in smoke and wearing cool clothes. And I just wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be in that room. And the album covers themselves are all designed by a guy named Reed Miles, who really changed the language graphic design, and you can see his influence everywhere now. But those covers just made such a strong individual statement. The whole culture around Blue Note was appealing to me, and I followed the company my whole life, right up until 2011, when I was, again, that same record. Talk about other records leading to situations. I was producing John Mayer. We had one night off, and I read that a singer named Gregory Porter was appearing up at a club near Harlem called Smoke. So on my night off, I went up there, and it was just the greatest show I'd seen in years, man. I sat through three sets, eating ribs and drinking coffee. And the next morning I had breakfast with a guy named Dan McCarroll. I don't know if you know Dan. He used to be a drummer, played with Sheryl Crow and Lloyd Cole and
Commotions.
And somehow he's one of the best guys ever.
Great guy.
And he worked his way up, and at that moment, he was president of Capitol Records. So we were just having breakfast. We're old friends. And right at the end of the breakfast, I said to Dan, I said, is Blue Note still part of Capitol? Because if it is, you should sign this guy that I saw last night. And he said, well, as it turns out, unbeknownst to me, Bruce Lundvall, who'd run the label for 30 years, was sick and he couldn't carry on. And they weren't quite sure what they were going to do to keep the ethos alive. There was some talk about just turning it into a website that sold catalog and blue t-shirts was the plan. Dan wasn't comfortable with it. And I came in with an idea on the day that they were looking for an idea.
Wow.
And he offered me the job right there in this little diner in New York City. He said, you should sign him.
Amazing.
So I never aspired to work at a record company.
Yeah.
My whole life was kind of devoted to avoiding having a job. If I just didn't have to, I never thought about playing or making records as being a job. As long as I didn't have to go get a job, I was okay. I was 58. I almost made it. And here's this irresistible offer. So I couldn't say no to that. I walked around for an hour, thought about it, and I was like, what the fuck? Let's do it.
And did you sign Gregory Porter?
That was the first call. Yeah, first call.
Amazing. Manager, huh? Great choice.
Yeah. Thank you. And then the second guy, I ended up on an airplane with a lawyer named Kenny Hertz, who I've known for years, and he represented Wayne Shorter. I said, would Wayne ever want to be on Blue Note again? And that was the second signing. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's really worked out. I love it. I love doing it. I love being a part of maintaining the legacy of the company and extending it. There's nothing, which I'm sure you know you've experienced time and time again, there's nothing quite like the feeling of finding a young artist and saying, come with us, and you see something build off of that, and you've enabled them to grow and to have their music heard. It's just a wonderful experience.
Absolutely. Tell me, what do you know about the beginnings of Blue Note? When was it founded? What's the story of from the beginning?
Founded in 1939 by two German immigrants, Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff, who were like getting away from Hitler. And they came over here, they were totally enamored of Black American music. Just started hanging out, listening to it. They were in a jazz club, not a bar, but like a chess club. they joined a club and they would talk about records and all that. And then their way in was to start recording some of the musicians they loved. So the first record was released in 1939. It's Meet Lex Lewis and Albert Ammons. And they just kept going. And it seemed that if there was a pattern there, it was that they signed artists who had strong fundamentals, knew the history of the music that came before them, had a gift, but were looking to push the threshold of what was then contemporary music and go one step beyond, do something new, and reflect the times that they lived in. So I jumped to 1948. They could have signed anybody in bebop. They signed Thelonious Monk, who was definitely left to center. Of course, we listen to Monk now. He's become such a part of the vocabulary. You don't think of it as radical music, but it was totally radical when he created it. And he changed the face of composition. He changed the nature of the way people voice chords. He's just had such an influence on generations to come. But they took a chance on him and repeated that again 5 or 6 years later when they put Art Blakey and Horace Silver together to form the Jazz Messengers. And and that became the birth of hard bop, which again, wow, revolutionized music.
Yeah.
You jumped into the 60s where I came on board as a fan, and they had Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter doing all these incredible modal things, but they had Ornette Coleman and Eric Dolphy and Cecil Taylor. And even the most commercial guy on the label was probably Jimmy Smith, the organ player. But what he was doing with the B3, even though you could dance to it and it had a groove, that was radical and revolutionary. No one had done that with a B3 before. That played bass with his hand and foot in combination. Like, that's incredible what Jimmy Smith did. So that seemed to be the legacy. That's the real essence of the label. And we try to continue that today. When my first day on the gig, Robert Glasper came in to play rough mixes of Black Radio, which I just remember being totally transported when I heard that, because I'd never heard anyone put hip hop and jazz together the way he did. on that record. People had done, you know, Roy Hargrove did incredible things, you know, 10 years earlier, but no one had done it quite like the way Robert was doing it. And I just remember being totally tripped out listening to it. And now that was, you know, that was maybe 9 years ago or something like that.
Incredible.
Now, if you go to like a student concert at any college, someone's going to get up and say, we'd like to do a Robert Glasper song now, Afro Blue, which of course is an old Mongo Santa Maria song that Coltrane cut, but everyone knows Robert's arrangement, and he's now become a permanent part of the jazz vocabulary. So the goal is to keep doing that.
Amazing. How often do you see someone who can fit in that lineage? Seems like they're few and far between.
Yeah, they are few and far between. Now, you don't see someone that often. But, you know, recently, I actually asked my son, my youngest kid, Solomon, the bass player, he's going to be 24 this year. And I said, who in your generation is like the Miles Davis of, you know, who? And he didn't hesitate. And he said, there's a vibes player out of Chicago named Joel Ross. So check him out. So we started watching the videos. And he was awesome, man. So I called him up. And he'd already had an album recorded. He was really sharp, really on the case. The more I hung with him, I realized that he was quite well known. And he's the leader among the musicians of his generation, in my opinion. I can see that when people play in his band, they play differently. He elevates their playing just by being with them. But wherever he goes to play, it changes, which reminds me of Miles. It reminds me of Charles Lloyd, same thing. So we signed him, and he put out a record about a year ago, and he's really blossoming. Now we just signed the guy who plays saxophone with him, Emmanuel Wilkins. That's a record coming out this year. Both Joel and Emmanuel have new records coming. So they're there. You know, people are out there. You just have to keep listening and stay open.
Yeah.
You
know? Sounds like the same like being in the studio, just the patience, you know?
That's it. It's exactly like that. And I think that a lot of the things I learned in the studio and also learned as an artist who ended up being produced by other people, I think that's been really helpful. I don't rule with an iron fist. In fact, I do the opposite. I try to sign people whose instincts I trust.
Yeah, absolutely. How did your relationship with the Stones begin?
They called me in 92. They just signed to Virgin Records, and Virgin Records was trying to get them to use a producer. And, you know, I was on the heels of all this B-52s, Bonnie Raitt stuff, and they suggested I go meet with them. So I went to New York City. It was right after Bill Wyman left the band, and they were auditioning new bass players. I went to SIR, and you got to understand, I saw them play for the first time in 1964, bought the first album, bought every album subsequently, went to every tour subsequently. And now here I was in a room watching them play the greatest hits, auditioning a bass player, and there's nobody else in the room. I just couldn't believe it. So then Mick and Keith come over, and they sit down next to me. I hadn't met Keith before, but I'd met Mick before. And they both started talking at the same time. and it was like watching a tennis match. You know, my head's going back and forth. Which guy do I listen to? And they did not yield to the other guy for, it felt like an eternity, but it was probably a good 3 minutes, right?
Yeah. Probably yet. Probably still to this day.
things haven't changed that much. But Keith was basically giving me, you know, all the reasons that they didn't need a producer. I don't need some fucking guy to tell me how to play guitar. And Mick wanted the producer, but he had his reasons. So they were both talking at the same time. And then they both stopped at the same time. And Keith said, you sure you want to be the meat in this sandwich? And I thought, oh man, they're never going to hire me, but I got a great story to tell my grandchildren. So I split that day thinking I was never going to see him again. And then Keith called me a couple of weeks later, and we figured out what they did need and what they don't need. He doesn't need someone to tell him how to play guitar. So I don't have to do that. But there are other things where having an objective third party helps.
Cool.
So it's been really nice. That was 1993. So it's 27 years.
Incredible.
And they've been good friends, like really good friends, and really generous guys, and they are the best rock and roll band ever, I think, you know, and I just every time we go in to make a record and I get to sit in that little circle with them playing live, I can't believe how good they are. And I've gotten to play with them too, which is nice. There have been times that Daryl Jones hasn't been able to be at a rehearsal or a session or something. When you play bass with them, you become aware that the conversation, the musical conversation that's going on, there's zero tension in it. It's quite jocular. They're having so much fun. And it's kind of like, you know, when you go to a baseball game, before the inning starts, there'd be several balls out in the field and they're just tossing it around, warming up before the inning starts. So that's kind of like what they do to each other. They throw each other these really nice softballs, these beautiful pitches that just land right in the glove, and that they're just flying around, and Charlie will play something that makes Keith play something that'll make Nick play sing something that'll make Ronnie play something. And they're so quick and there's so much listening and it's so improvised and it's so much fun, man. They have a ball when they play.
It's great. Tell me about the show in 1964. What was it like seeing them back then?
I didn't know anything about it, man. No one knew who they were in 1960. It was like February 1964, or March or something like that. And the Beatles had just been on Ed Sullivan. So everyone was totally into this whole notion of English groups coming over. And here's another Beatles kind of group. And they played the Olympia Stadium in Detroit, which is a hockey arena. And there were maybe 300 people in a place that held 18,000.
Wow.
But a couple of weeks later, they were, they were on Ed Sullivan, and then they were huge.
How would you say your relationship to music has changed from the time you were a kid, from the time that you were in your mom's car and you heard that saxophone?
Yeah.
How has your relationship to music changed to today?
Well, there's maybe just a little bit of awareness of the backbone behind what you see, but the impact is still exactly the same. But there's a lot of research about like the neurological implications of music, that the part of the brain that processes music is there originally so you could communicate with babies. It's for pre-language communication. Right? And so like a mother coos to a baby, "Oh, look at the baby." That's music. Those are intervals. And those intervals are repeated in disparate cultures all over the world. Same thing. It soothes a baby. But once you learn to speak, by the time you're 3 years old, maybe you close that area of the brain down. We close down 19 of 20 active synapses by the time we're 12 or something like that, because we can't have them all open. And we keep open the synoptic pathways that we use. And we keep the music one open. Well, why is that? I think it's because conversational language, no matter how articulate and deep you get with it, it still fails to convey the full depth of our inner emotional lives. That's why we have art, because you have to convert these emotions to another medium in order to communicate that to somebody. And great art is made by someone who is willing to dig deep inside and take something, something that makes them really uncomfortable and really, tears them up, and bring that out in some way and share that with other people so that when they receive it, it puts them in touch with their lives. So anything that brings you some understanding of what's going on inside of you, anything that even just brings you comfort for 3 minutes, that's an amazing thing to offer to people. So I just know that even before I was making music, I was impacted by music, and that it soothed my soul and made life bearable. And it's nothing has changed. And that's it. I just have a little bit of insight into how you can get that from the artist to the listener. It's still all magic and all. It's a big fucking mystery.
Yeah, we're so lucky that we get to feel that on a regular basis.
I feel super fortunate, Rick. I really do.
Cool, man.
It's a great way to spend your life.
You can hear all of our favorite Don Was related tracks on a playlist we created for this episode at brokenrecordpodcast.com. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel where you can find all of our past episodes and also some great bonus material. You can subscribe at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia LaBelle, Leah Rose, Eric Sandler, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music is by Kenny Beats. Thanks for listening. I'm Justin Richmond.